Shrink with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Amanda. Welcome to the 56th episode of Robots. In today's episode, we'll be looking at nanorobotics from the hardware side to the control. In particular, we'll be talking to one of the most renowned world leaders in the field, Ari Rakisha from the University of Southern California.
Our second guest, Grégory Mermoux, has had the chance to meet with Ari Rakisha on several occasions during conferences, and we're taking advantage of their common interests in having both of them in today's podcast edition. But first, as always, let's hear the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. Researchers at the University of Washington have developed a microrobot with 512 feet. The robot is about the size of a fingernail and weighs about half a gram. Each of the 512 robot feet consists of an electrical wire sandwiched between two materials that expand differently under heat. By passing a current through the electrical wire, one material expands more than the other, making the feet curl. The small size of the feet results in a very large surface area compared to the volume, which makes it possible to heat up or cool down the feet in less than 20 milliseconds, allowing the robot to take 20 to 30 tiny steps per second. Another advantage of the bimetal feet is their strength, allowing the robot to carry more than 7 times its own weight. The researchers are now optimizing the robot for efficiency, to improve its current 10-minute power autonomy, as well as its speed, which is currently limited to about 1 meter per hour. A team at Carnegie Mellon University and Pennsylvania-based company Piasecki Aircraft have developed and tested a navigation system for a full-size helicopter that allows autonomous flight and obstacle avoidance at low altitudes. The system is based on navigation and planning software developed at CMU for use in robotic ground vehicles. Using inertial sensing and a laser scanner, it builds 3D maps of the ground and finds obstacles in the aircraft's path. In a series of tests, the system demonstrated detection of a variety of objects that could block a potential landing site, such as 4-inch high pallets, chain-link fences, vegetation, or people. The system also proved capable of detecting and maneuvering around a 20-meter high manlift while flying at a speed of more than 20 knots, and of detecting high-tension wires over desert terrain. Development of the technology was driven by the goal to allow future unmanned helicopters to evacuate wounded soldiers from contaminated or active battlefields, and to resupply military bases in combat zones. The technology could also be used as a pilot aid to help avoid obstacles such as power lines. Since the software keeps a running rank of possible landing sites and approach abort paths, another use could be identification of landing sites in emergency situations, including low light or low visibility conditions. For more information on this centipede robot and the autonomous helicopter navigation system, have a look at the robots forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Ari Rakisha is a pillar and world-renowned expert in the field of nanorobotics. As such, he's the founding director of the Laboratory of Molecular Robotics at the University of Southern California and editor-in-chief of IEEE Transactions on Nanotechnology. We met with him at ICRA during a workshop on nanorobotics for a snapshot view of the current state and future of robotics at the nanoscale. Hi, Ari. Welcome to Robots. Can you please present yourself to our listeners?
My name is Ari Rakisha. I have been running a nanorobotics lab for the past 15 years at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. I also happen to be the editor-in-chief of the IEEE Transactions on Nanotechnology for the past 4 years.
So the director of the Laboratory of Molecular Robots, what does that mean?
Primarily, it means that we are doing nanorobotics. Now, what is that? Nanorobotics, we like to define as having three directions. One is manipulation of objects that are at the nanoscale, and the nanoscale for us is something that's between 1 and 100 nanometers. So you manipulate these very small objects with things that are larger, like scanning probe microscopes. The second is the more glamorous part of nanorobotics, is trying to build complete robots made out of components that are themselves nanoscopic. And once you put all these components together, you will end up with something that's probably a micron in size. So it would be the size of a small biological cell. And that's, as I said, the most exciting part of nanorobotics, but it is also the one that is less developed. The third aspect has to do with programming of nanorobots. So suppose you do build one, what would you do with it? And the answer is, if you have only one, you would probably not do very much with it, because they're very small and they probably will have very limited capabilities. So you would need a swarm, a large number of these nanorobots. And now suppose you have 1,000 or 10,000 or 1,000,000, how would you program them, given that that probably a large proportion is going to fail or going to get lost somehow? How do you go ahead and keep do anything useful with these?
So let's go along these three points, maybe, starting by how we actually build these nanostructures and AFM manipulation of microparticles. What are the challenges and how have you been going about this?
Well, we have looked at AFM manipulation since the beginning of this effort, and we have been looking at small particles. You see, a lot of people have been trying to manipulate things that are about 100 nanometers in size. We have been looking at more like 10 nanometers, because we think that's the area that's most interesting, given that there aren't many other approaches to making anything at that scale. Whereas if you are at a larger scale, you can use lithography and electron beam lithography and things like that. So we've been working in that area. And what we tried to do was to solve a fundamental problem, which is that manipulation with atomic force microscopes is very labor intensive. If you want to make a pattern with like 20 particles in some specific positions, in the past, that's taken somebody with a PhD in 5 years of experience a whole day or an afternoon to do this. So what we tried to do then was to automate the whole thing. And that has been achieved. So we're pretty happy with that. Now, what are people going to do with that? I think they haven't really thought yet enough about it, but this opens the possibility of building large structures, fairly complicated structures, which in the past was impossible because it took so long. So from many hours, we can do same thing in a few minutes.
And can maybe you explain an AFM for someone who doesn't know what it is?
Well, an AFM is a special case of what's called a scanning probe microscope. And that is the AFM itself, the business end of it, is a cantilever. There is a beam that's attached to one side and free on the other. And on the free side, it has a very sharp tip. And the radius at the apex of the tip is only a few nanometers, and that is the part that actually interacts with the sample, the thing that you want to manipulate. this cantilever and tip can be controlled and can be moved around. So, and to manipulate something, basically you push it with the tip of this microscope.
So once you've been able to make structures using this AFM, what do you think will be the challenges in making a full working a micro level robot like you mentioned before?
Okay, so this we just talked about building some kind of structure with the atomic force microscope. And the big challenge there is how to do it faster. Now that we can do it automatically, we still take too long. So it at the moment, this kind of manipulation is used primarily for prototyping devices. And it's interesting because you can play with the parameters of the devices. For example, if you have some kind of a gap between two particles, and you can move them so that you investigate what is the effect of that gap on the behavior of the device. Now, how do you build robots? Well, that's a complicated issue. And at the moment, nobody has really built a robot at that scale yet. So what do we have? Well, we have very simple things like nanoparticles that are used for drug delivery. Are they a robot? Not really, but they have some kind of sensing because the surface of the particle can be coated with, say, antibodies to something. And so those will recognize any molecule that is on the surface of a cell, for example. So if you do that the right way, you might be able to find some cancer cells, for example. Unfortunately, cancer cells tend not to be recognizable on the basis of a single marker. You need patterns of markers and a lot of them, and that complicates the issue. But so those nanoparticles, they have some kind of sensor, they have some actuation in that they can deliver the drug. They don't have locomotion on their own. They move around, say, in the blood, so they go with the flow. And, well, a robot is supposed to sense, think, and act. Do these things think? Not very much, right? So that exists, and it's being used, and some of these have actually been approved by the FDA for clinical use. Beyond that, what we have now in the labs are components. So we got sensors. For example, these nanowire sensors are very promising. We have some actuators. We have nanoelectronics around, so you could presumably build logic using nanoelectronics. We have problems, two big problems at the moment. One is power, the other one is communications. If we could solve those, we could build networks of sort of impoverished robots, better known as sensors. Okay. So we could build a sensor network that could be embedded in some biological system. And I would imagine first we would try to do that on cellular systems in vitro and try to... So imagine that you'd have like 100 sensors or even more, and they are all working in multiple modes, measuring different things, all with pretty high resolution, both in space and in time. I think that would give us information that might take us closer to actually understanding what the biology is doing. But we need to power them, and we need to extract the signals out of them. And it's not really practical to do that with wires. So we need some wireless communication and some way to power these things. If we had them, we would first, I think, have these instrumented cell systems, and then we would evolve towards an instrumented body in which we would be monitoring what's going on, and that could lead to early detection of disease and to a whole paradigm shift from treating disease like we do today to preventing them. If we could find that somebody has a few bacteria in him, in his or her body, we could perhaps kill them before the person even knew that he or she was going to get sick.
So you mentioned that the particles right now don't think, and you mentioned this communication basically with multi-robot systems. What is your vision in terms of swarming?
Well, as I said earlier, I think the applications of this technology are pretty much going to require that you have swarms, just because each of these gadgets is going to be very limited in capabilities. And you will have either swarms of sensors or eventually swarms of more capable things, because, again, if you take a sensor and you add intelligence and mobility, you have a robot, basically. If you take a few sensors and do that.
I want to go back to the AFM short moment, because you're able to basically manipulate these very small particles, and this made me think a bit of a molecular manufacturing. How far do you think we can go in really building up material from the basic atoms?
To build significant amounts of material, you either have to have a very large number of robots working in parallel to build them. And some of the talks in the session today were beginning to try to address that, but the numbers are not there yet, okay? We would need orders of magnitude improvement in the numbers of robots that can be made to work in parallel. Or we have to use something that's more like self-assembly. And self-assembly until now has been kind of hard to control.
And do you think these future nanorobots will be more bio-like, engineering-like, or some mix between?
There may be a mix between them, and there will be people, as they are now, there are people who are trying to build them using biological components, and there are people who are trying to build them without them. And the problem I have with the biological components is that we don't really understand how they work all that well. And if we started from scratch with materials that we understand better, we would have a better chance of actually understanding how to build these things and what we do.
And what time frame are we looking at? When will we start to see the first nanorobots which have some application?
I always say 10 to 20 years, because that sounds safe. But we don't really know. There could be a breakthrough, and you could have something interesting out. In this conference, there are papers in which people have gadgets, very tiny gadgets, moving inside the body. So we're not... Now, are those real interesting robots? Well, it's probably not yet, but there is progress, and it's very hard to guess.
You brought up another problem, which is autonomy, before. Mm-hmm. Do you have any insight into how that's going to be solved?
Well, to have autonomy, you're going to need to have some thinking ability, and that very simple thinking, like just reactive kinds of thinking, would not be all that difficult to implement if we had the working nanoelectronic logic, and there's a big push on nanoelectronics all over the world, so I think that's going to happen.
Okay, thanks, Ari, for your insight on nanorobotics.
Okay. Thank you.
Gregory Mermot is a PhD student at the Distributed Intelligent Systems and Algorithms Lab. Gregory's research focuses on developing efficient and original methodologies for modeling and engineering self-organization and self-assembly of a broad range of systems, including distributed robotics, micro-nano systems, chemical systems, and intelligent agents.
Hi, Greg, and welcome to Robots. Hi, Amanda.
Could you please present yourself to our listeners?
So, my name is Grégory Mermoux, and I'm a PhD student at EPFL in the Distributed Intelligent Systems and Algorithms Laboratory, headed by Professor Martinoni. And my main research interests are distributed robotic systems with a special emphasis on scalability. And by scalability, I mean two different things. First, the scalability in terms of the size of the swarm, if you want, the number of robots which are involved in the system. And second, the size of these robots. So we are trying to develop algorithms and methodologies for designing and controlling swarms of very small robots, hopefully down to the sub-millimeter scale. And one of the very important case study and very important concept in general which I work with is the concept of self-assembly, because this is this is a process, if you want, which is intrinsically scalable. And so it is very, very well suited to the study of scalability in robotic systems.
Is there a difference between self-assembly and aggregation?
Yes, the difference is very simple. It's the fact that self-assembly is a kind of structured aggregation, if you want. So instead of just having like a bunch of robots which are connected to each other in some way, you rather have a lattice or a chain or any particular shape you want to form. So this is the difference.
Okay. So you mentioned scalability before. So let's imagine that we are really going to be able to scale your micro-robots down to the nanorobot size. What kind of breakthrough would we have to make in self-assembly to be able to perform things like molecular manufacturing when you're building materials from basic atoms?
Yeah. So I think one of the... So in general, first, if you want to use self-assembly for doing anything at any scale, the most important thing is the controllability of the process. And this is the main challenge of self-assembly. And you don't want to be micromanaging, because as soon as you try to micromanage self-assembly, it's no longer self-assembly. So you need the things to be a bit parallel, automating. And so it's by designing properly the building blocks, whatever they are. They could be robots, they could be molecules, they could be atoms. Of course, you can't really design atoms, but it's just a matter of moving them properly. So then this is really the point which is the most important one if you want to achieve proper structures. So in the case of atomic, like if you want to use atoms to build an object, a molecular robot if you want, then some people use AFM, but this is not self-assembly at all. This is just pick and place. And there is exactly the same thing at higher scales, like at the micro scale, micrometer scale. You use robotic pick and place to move around MEMS building blocks to form some structures. But these techniques are all very limited in terms of throughput, because they are intrinsically sequential. If you want, you can have multiple AFM tips or multiple robotic arms, but you don't have the scalability in terms of the number of building blocks which you assemble at the same time. Just such as in the case of self-assembly.
Mm-hmm. In terms of capabilities, so Ari Rakisha says in his previous interview that today's nanorobots can sense and actuate, but without really thinking and without deliberative locomotion. So in your opinion, which of these two skills is more critical to the utility of potential applications?
So I think it's definitely sensing, because without sensing, actuation is useless, at least in the context of autonomous units. Because like if you take the example of a killer cell robot, if it doesn't have the ability to identify a certain species of cells than like cancer cells with respect to healthy cells. In that case, you would just have like a very stupid robot which would kill all the cells in your body. So really, I think sensing comes first, and then you have actuation. But of course, both things are very important if you want to achieve like fully fledged robots.
Ari also mentions that one of the other big challenges remains the issue of communication. So assuming that, yeah, that we can solve this problem otherwise, for instance, in a system which has sensing capabilities, how do you think one can avoid this shortcoming, this bottleneck?
I think here what we need to do is to distinguish between two different kinds of communication, because you have first the communication to the exterior world, if you want, like to a base station or to the user of these robots, whatever it is, and I think this is a very big problem if you want to use conventional communication, like I don't know, like wireless communication, conventional wireless communication, because you need power on the robots, and this won't be solved soon, let's say. And you need also an antenna, and these antennas, they scale very badly, let's say. Anyway, and so this is a very difficult problem. And I think there this won't be solved in a conventional way before a long time. Also, if you consider inter-robot communication, so if you want to have coordination in your system, there I think you can use completely different schemes. And so we had a recent paper at AMS where we tried to use aggregation as a beaconing mechanism for case studies such as perception, such as collective perception and actuation. And in that paper, we really just used the fact that two robots encounter each other. So it's just a message that they send to each other, if you want, to say, oh, here I am. And so it means something, it means that basically I made like the same decision as you before because I'm at the same place or something like this. So there are really a lot of different ways where you could just replace conventional communication by something different. And I think in the case of communication from the robots to the user, to the base station there, you could imagine a lot of different solutions, like if you use a microscope, like an MRI, and you can detect these small robots, and you could detect a change in their shape, their size, or, I don't know, their luminescence or something, then you could use this signal as also as a message that right. Something is happening in the system, and so therefore you would replace conventional communication by something else.
Is this some sort of stigmergy?
I mean, in the case of let's say inter-robot communication, definitely stigmergy could play a key role. As soon as you have sensing, you can implement stigmergy as a communication mechanism. So this is definitely a very, very clear path for micro-robot communication.
Okay. So it seems to me that there's a lot of thought which has to go into the design of the robots themselves and actually the robot systems. And there are basically two approaches that I see one could apply to doing this. So there's the bottom-up approach and the top-down approach. In your opinion, is one or the other more effective, or do you think that they're both just as good, and where do you think that these two approaches might meet?
So effective, it's clear that the bottom-up approach is way more effective than the top-down. If you think of manufacturing, for instance, at the micro scale, the typical top-down approach is to use robotic pick and place, for instance, or first lithography step, where you will basically have a bulk of material, which then you will remove selectively in order to structure your robot or whatever you want to manufacture. And then if you have two different components which you want to put together in order to have a functional system, you will need to use robotic pick and place with all the limitations and the problem of cost efficiency and so on and so forth that it involves. Now, the bottom-up approach, namely, and one clear example of bottom-up approach is the self-assembly, is very effective because it's cheap. I mean, it should be at least, and it's very, very, very effective in terms of throughput. So, but the problem, of course, is that the controllability is very difficult. Whereas in the case of top-down approaches such as robotic pick-and-place, it's very easy to control these systems. So I think there there is a clear trade-off to study there. And this is one of the things we are doing in the project Selfsys, which is funded by nanoterra.ch, which is a Swiss initiative for, let's say, the development of micro systems and other kind of systems. And in this project, we are really trying to use self-assembly as an enabling technology for the manufacturing of hybrid MEMS. And also, we use top-down approaches such as photolithography to manufacture the basic building blocks, but then we use bottom-up approaches such as self-assembly in order to bring them together or to have a better throughput in certain processes and so on. So, and I think it's not clear where the frontier is, but these kind of initiatives will probably make it clear soon.
Okay, that's very interesting. And this concludes our interview. Thank you, Gregory.
Thank you.
For more information on our guests and discussions on the latest hot topics in robotics, make sure to visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Shrink with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.